day.
Grant and Rachel Coburn. Grant Coburn. Good afternoon and welcome. Sorry to keep you waiting. We're just...
Sorry to keep you guys waiting.
It's all right. Right, we've received the original submission. Thanks very much for putting that in. You don't need to read it out to us, because we've already read it, but you're very welcome to speak to it and highlight your key points of concern for us.
Okay, cheers. I'm Grant Coburn. Rachel, sorry, can't be here today, so I'll just read to this. We farm a 3,400 hectare property in the Tianhe Basin, where we're currently undertaking a consented development program, which will increase the stock carrying capacity over the next 5 years. This will leave still 48% of the property will be protected under Kerry 2 covenants once completed. This project was undertaken with the advice of key stakeholders, Environment Southland, District Council, Fish and Game, Wild Trust, Kerry 2, iwi, etc. We continue to get advice as we implement the development from ES staff and the Wild Trust and the Q2 regarding the best measures to protect our waterways. Our project has been described as a model for future development. With this in mind, I'd just like to raise the following brief points in conjunction with my submission for the Water and Land Plan. Rule 23, intensive winter grazing. Obviously, actually, in my submission, there were some areas that I gave the example of Mount Prospect.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go over them again, but clearly it's more than 50 hectares. And I'm worried that also with this development program here, obviously we'll do more than 50 hectares and go into the next category, which would be an average of your last 3 years. So I'm going to break that as well. So that's why I'm sort of asking you to consider a percentage basis. If those first triggers are exceeded, then ultimately, big picture, you know, percentage wise, we're okay. So that was all really on the intensive winter grazing side of it. So you've obviously been heard a lot about that. The extraction of surface water, Rule 49. My understanding, anything over 86,000 litres a day, we'd need a consent. So just basically wanted to, we actually use about that at the peak now. Obviously with the carrying capacity lifting, we'll be over that. So I just want something put in as part of my submission that there's available surface water for stock drinking purposes, basically. Rule 52, water abstraction from whale catchment. We support the recommendation, I see there, 8.294 I think it is, given the ability to access groundwater for irrigation if a low connectivity is proven between the ground and surface water. So I support that. I do refer to Brian Elwood's report that was done supporting the Meridian submission, basically saying I think there's up to 52,000 hectares that are going to turn into irrigation. We're going to convert all dairying and dairy support, and you know, we're all going to get it. You know, which would obviously cause some major issues. I'd just like to temper that a bit with where are we? That the land contour and the 52,000 hectares will limit quite a bit of that, and the big rubber meeting the road is the future nitrogen limit setting process. So I think it's fair that people should still be able to irrigate if that's part of their system and are still well within the limits that the land and water plan is obviously heading towards. So yeah, just wanted to temper that report a bit. Mm-hmm. And then objective 6, maintain water quality. Obviously that's the key thing. I'd just like to keep any nitrate mania, I suppose, in context. That is my main concern as a farmer, is if the nitrates were similar to phosphate and E. coli, which is a lot of overland, you know, issues getting in waterways, We can fix that when we're fixing it. The nitrate side of it, I suppose, I'm worried that we are going to continue to, it is going to continue to lift just through natural intensification. I think I used an example in my submission, you know, the Tianau Basin is still mainly, you know, up until 5 or 6 years ago, was still mainly a sheep and beef basin. And if you look at the nitrate levels, they have risen in the last 30 years just through normal farming intensification. So I think there needs to be some headroom there to allow just a normal, you know, and therefore with that, when I say allow, if the phosphates and E. coli and all that is the very low levels, what is a level that's, you know, clearly we want our waterways to maintain the life in the water, the invertebrates and the fish and, you know, all that healthy life. If the river's healthy, can it be healthy? This is my question, I don't know, but can it be still healthy with a level of 2 or 3? I don't know, you know? So, and I think at the moment our average in the basin, I'm guessing from looking last time, on average it has peaked over 1, I think, occasionally, but on average it's still quite below 1. So I just don't want us to be completely limited because we're the last sort of area in Southland to convert to farming, basically.
Yeah.
So just want to keep that in context.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's all, thanks.
Okay. Just in terms of that, the setting of in-stream nitrogen and phosphorus limits is not so much an issue for what we're doing, it's an issue for the council's freshwater management unit process
going forward.
And so the government's just changed the national policy statement of freshwater management. There's a 2017 version which just came out, and this council and every other council in New Zealand is going to now have to set nitrogen and phosphorus limits in their rivers to achieve whatever periphyton limit they decide is appropriate, periphyton being algae. So that's going to be a challenge not only for this council but all the councils in New Zealand going forward. So there'll be a lot of water to go under that project.
Yes.
I'll see if we have any questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got just a couple more clarification really. In your original submission on policy 16, you've made mention of close proximity, and you've said 1 kilometre, 10 kilometres, 20 kilometres. You'd actually like a better indication of what close proximity means. In your view, and considering where you farm, what do you consider to be close proximity?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think only from memory, is it the Lagoon Creek, an area in Lagoon Creek, and I think that we'll be more than a couple of k's away from that, so I'd say that's not close proximity. Maybe a kilometre or something, or 500 metres, I'm not sure. It's all depending on how much effect things have on that, I suppose.
So it could be down to metres, that's what I'm suggesting. So it could be 200 metres or 100 metres or something.
I don't know, I suppose, I haven't really thought about it, to be fair. I've sort of, because it's so vague, it's like, it'd be good to put a number around it so it's at least gives an idea where people, everyone's on the same page, you know.
I'll just move on to the physiographic zones and the talk in your submission under Rule 22, new dairy farming. But I just want to pick up the point that you raised there, that in your view, is it not clear in the plan how multiple physiographic zones would be handled on a property?
It took me a while, but after reading a few times, I think I actually come to the conclusion that was it under 10 hectares or?
No, I'm just asking whether it was clear to you that was all.
Yeah, it was after a while, and I'm now thinking why it was that in there, but. I thought it wasn't clear enough for most people. It took me a long time to sort of work it out, so it's just maybe just make it clear. That's what it was.
And then I just want to shoot across the last page, which is Appendix N. And I think I'm picking up your theme here is in the Appendix N, you would actually like the sediment, the N, the P, and the E. coli to be more clearly managed on a property by property basis than just being general farming practice. Is that the intent of what you were saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, I do these sorts of things and this deals with E, and I do these sorts of things and this deals with P. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, it's covered me too, thanks.
You're right.
You're developing the property.
Yes.
Still currently in, which involves about 200 hectares of winter feed per year, which is about 10% of your effective property?
At the moment, I can't remember the figures I've got down there, there's about 200 hectares and on about, I was thinking of the developed land, so. But that's correct, it's 200 hectares now, the total area is always the same, and there's, yeah, increasing amounts of developed land within that. So if we keep it 200 hectares, the percentage of the whole property obviously won't change, but the developed area will change. So, so I suppose it's just in relation to that 3-year thing. It's like, well, where do I fit here? You know, we're still going to have half the property protected and
that's quite an impressive area and potentially in Kiwi too, government.
Yeah, it is, but it's above 500 metres, it's not all above 500 metres, there's some within that, you know, wetlands and creek gullies. And
Not grazable.
But it would have been, I suppose the nice thing about home is we're a lot later out of the blocks developing, so, but it's given us a fantastic opportunity to, there's some deeply incised, you know, the main Moat Creek and things comes out, well that's all fenced and, you know, massive margins and things, so, yeah, we're pretty proud of it, so, I suppose we've been lucky enough to be able to develop some of the potential out of it, even though we've been a bit late starting, but I think it'll be a good thing in the end, I mean, yeah, it'll look good.
I just really wanted to clarify that 10%, for example, or something like that.
Yeah, so I think about the in time, it might be up to 350 hectares. Yeah. Well, when it's all done, so it'll be about 10% of the total property.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just lastly on that, I suppose it's all within one title, and what I wouldn't want to see happen going forward is the land and water plan. I didn't see the indication of it, but I'd hate property to be broken into segments and say the end loss in this area is too high, this is fine, this is fine, this is fine, and then you've got to sort of spread it out. Mm-hmm. To me, the value of having half the property in QE2 should be a benefit to us, yeah, to be able to utilise the more productive areas, you know.
Yes.
So I'd, you know, obviously that would, you know, change our perspective of the whole land and water plan if that happened. So yeah. I hope that's not on the cards.
Yep. Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I had three questions, Grant, come from your submission. One, to do with minimising losses, really. So what practices can be undertaken to limit sediment runoff, even in heavy rain? You talk about when it rains heavily, it's a problem, we all know that. But what things can be done that can be incorporated into a farm management plan, say, to limit sediment losses even in heavy rain?
Well, I suppose what I'm saying there is in a heavy rain event, to limit sediment loss, i.e. stop the river's turning brown, I don't think there is anything. To limit it, maybe reduce it slightly, yeah, but to actually stop it, I suppose.
No, you probably can't stop it, but to reduce it, perhaps that's a better word.
Well, I think outside the best management practices, there's not a lot. I think that within the best management practices, if we follow that, then we're doing most of what we can, I think. Is that why they're put in place?
Yeah, okay. What about nitrate losses? You've got some oxidising soil in your place, haven't
yep.
you? What about, if you did talk about nitrogen and allowing the background level to build up a bit, and that's a FMU process, but there are ways that you can reduce the amount, again, of nitrogen that is lost by that mechanism. So what things could be in a farm management plan or maybe in some permitted activities to reduce nitrogen being lost to groundwaters?
Yeah, well, I mean, I noticed in the last 12 months talking about the catch crop, you know, after winter grazing, and to me, where we are, I mean, I have tried that before, not necessarily through trying to reduce nitrogen, but through growing oats and to make it, and you know, we're at 370 metres above sea level on the flat, and at the moment we're a lot wetter, so to actually get the crops in and allow them to mature to, you know, where you want them to, you can lose a month real quick. So suddenly, I mean, if it worked and we could do it, I'm more than open to, you know, if economically it's, even if it didn't make any more money, but meaning you can still perform the rest of your business and throw in an extra catch crop, I'd be great into it. I think with I'd be a little bit dubious on getting it in time to be able to allow to get your grass or your next crop in. That would be my concern. And then the next sort of, I suppose, from then on to reduce your nitrogen, I just see to make a meaningful reduction in nitrogen, it's to do a stocking rate. And that's the bit that starts gouging in the profit pretty quick. So, you know, and that's why I brought that up. It's like, I'm not averse to doing things to, you know, if I could do things to reduce the losses, as with phosphate and E. coli and all that, well, we're doing quite a lot towards that because it makes us feel good and it fits. And you know, it's the nitrogen thing that I'm just saying it's harder.
But you could incorporate those sorts of things into a farm management plan, even if it was sort of reasonably general, I suppose. Could you, or are they too specific or too...
Oh, no, you can put that into a plan, but it would have to be workable. It has to actually work. Otherwise, I'm not very good at writing a whole lot of stuff down if genuinely it's not going to happen. No. You know, I'm pretty basic like that. So I'd sooner talk about it now and raise some issues with it, not from a fighting point of view, but just a genuine trying to work around how to do it. You know? In saying that, I do now we've actually regrassed a lot of the farm since we, I suppose, converted to dairy support. So actually all the flats are regrassed now, so they'll actually slow down on the area that's actually, you know, in winter crop. Because obviously the winter, the paddock of fodder beet is obviously the, you know, that is the issue. So I will now look to spread that away, you know, rather than, because in the past it's sort of been a bit condensed there, because that's where I've been able to grow fodder beet for a start. Now I'm growing fodder beet over the rest of the paddocks, that's taking the pressure off the flats. So I think that's probably all stuff that's happening without me realising or really thinking too hard about it. And we've got lucerne on the flats as well. My understanding is that's the end loss out of the lucerne is actually relatively low, I think. So those sorts of things. But outside that, I'm just struggling with what else we can do.
And lastly, in terms of the farm management plan, in terms of auditing it or checking to make sure that what people say they are doing, they are actually doing, how do you see that working?
Yeah, well, that's a massive one, because it's only really recently that I finally got my fertiliser contractor. They're finally now all on track map. I think that's massive. You've got to have them all on the one or the whatever reliable system, because, for example, they were on precision mapping. I had a look, you know, after they've been and looked on the computer to see where they've been. Well, apparently they'd gone up the Prospect Road and spread 5-tonne lime all the way up and then 5-tonne lime all the way down, you know. So clearly someone had pushed the button. There wasn't 10-tonne lime on the track, right? But it made me think, you know, that's on the computer. How do you know that that didn't go on? You know, it's on the system. So I think TrackMap, there's no way it can get on the map without it coming out the bulky. You know, to me, that's the real simple ground root or grassroots stuff that's got to be dead right. It's idiot proof, and because ultimately, when we come to, you know, how much has gone on the farm, particularly in our situation, you could actually, you know, we've got a lot of area we won't be putting fertiliser on, so our end of year balance thing, or end of year mainland minerals thing, we'll have total tonnage, and you'll look at the area and say, oh, that's fine, but, you know, I might be overcooking it in areas, and so, yeah. And ultimately, and they're talking about in the consent, I think if you're not changing a lot within a consent, then it should be a consent that's there until the land and water plan changes, we have to redo them all again, I think. And it's got to be like the tax department, I suppose, that one day you get audited. And if you're found to be cooking the books, then obviously fines and whatever have to be in place.
All right, thanks very much.
Yeah.
And just no question, but a comment from our guests. For us, it's lucky that this version of the plan doesn't get into on-farm nitrogen loss management, and it doesn't require the auditing of farm environment plans, so that'll be matters for the fresh water management unit process going forward. So there'll be a few heads scratched during that process.
And that's where I feel it's a little bit disjointed, because that's where I want to get to, that's the bit I want to talk about.
Yeah, that's right, I can tell.
Because that's the rubber meeting the road, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly does. All right, thanks very much for coming in and speaking to your submission. It's been helpful.
Okay, thanks, Will.